Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, this is Nicole Ferraro, editorial director at the Webby Awards.
And Jason Brickhill, social media manager at the Webbys.
And we are excited because the nominees for the 22nd annual Webby Awards have been announced.
Woo!
Yes, that means it's time for you to go vote in the Webby People's Voice Awards for your favorite nominees across all categories and media types, including websites, film and video, advertising, media and PR, mobile sites and apps, social, podcasts and digital audio, and games.
You can vote once in every category from now until Thursday, April 19th, and help your favorite nominees take home a Webby this year.
Last year, over 3.5 million votes were cast during Webby People's Voice. That's a lot. So go make sure that your voice is heard in deciding the best of the internet and start voting now.
Nicole, where do people vote?
Vote.webbyawards.com.
Vote.webbyawards.com. Go vote!
From the Webby Awards, I'm David Michelle Davies. This is the Webby Podcast.
This summer will be legendary.
Free art for kids too.
Mitch better have my money.
Design with passion.
From Italy.
Hey, welcome back. My guest for this episode can easily be described as the authority of all things design, Paola Antonelli. She's a senior curator of the Department of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art. Since starting at the MoMA in 1994, she shaped the ways in which the museum and modern culture perceive and define design. A large portion of her work has been to include digital technology in that definition. She's broken boundaries by including a collection of video games in MoMA's design exhibits, which was a serious faux pas in traditional art communities at the time, and even helped build the museum's first webpage. We talked a bit about Paola's background, from her education in architecture and how she was plugged into early internet culture while still living in Italy, and quickly dove into a great conversation on how future tech will impact how we communicate with one another, her well-known R&D salon series on protests in the digital age, and much more.
I grew up in Milan, in Italy. I was born in Sardinia and I lived with my parents, you know, in different parts of Italy because of my father's job. But then Milan was their city and is my city. And I was here until 24 years ago when I came to New York City. And my background is truly, I'm an architect by training. Before that, I studied also economics, but I switched to architecture. And from there, I grew into becoming a journalist and a curator and a teacher of architecture and design.
And did you move to the United States to study architecture?
No. I studied in Milan.
Okay.
I graduated from the Polytechnic of Milan. And I started there as a journalist. I was at first at Domus and then I was at Abitare.
Okay.
And at the same time, I was also teaching at UCLA. So my first city in the United States was Los Angeles, actually. But I wasn't there.
It's a great city for an architect.
It was fantastic. And it's also a great city for a little Milanese girl wanting to just like break away. And it always gives me the sense of freedom and lightness. Even though I knew architects and artists, it was really hard work. And I got to probably see the best of LA, but still it makes me truly happy, as does New York.
So you really started out journalism, writing about
Architecture. See, in Italy, there's people, at least when I was going to school, people didn't really go to journalism school or to curatorial studies school. You would learn something and then you would either practice it, you would write about it, you would talk about it, you would curate it, which makes for maybe really bad prose in journalism, but really serious content. So the role of editors in Italy should be even more important. But so, yeah, At the same time, I was writing, curating. I worked as an architect for 6 months, but I really was not good at it. So I rapidly moved to another field, another application of architecture and design.
You seem a little too relaxed to be an architect.
Well,
I mean,
that
as a compliment.
I don't know. I just I'm impatient.
Okay.
Architects take a really long time before they see something realized, at least, you know, at once upon a time. And also, I'm not a good politician or diplomat. And the biggest part of the work of an architect is dealing with clients and with the powers that be, whether it's the city or neighbors. I just couldn't deal with it.
Was MoMA the reason you moved to New York?
Yeah. I moved to New York. I got the job by reading an ad in a magazine. It was ID magazine, not ID,
yeah.
The British one.
Sure.
ID was Industrial Design Magazine. And there was the ad for the position. And I knew already the people at MoMA because of my job as a writer. So I had interviewed also Terry Riley, that was the chief curator. So I wrote to him and he was like, really? And then I got the job. So I moved for that reason. And the move was quite traumatic. Because I moved here in February of 94, which was a really terrible February in an infamous winter with 17 snowstorms. So it was really tough in the beginning. But then I got my first show and I forgot all troubles.
It's also a really interesting time to move here for that role because it, at least unless you were really paying attention to what was going on with technology, it was still before the world at large was really paying attention to the web and the internet. There was, you know, people were using Mosaic browser in 1993, 1994, people in universities and young people and people who were really into computers. But in terms of a thing that the world was paying attention to, it was a little bit early still. And it's really become eventually a big part of what you do.
Yeah,
here, right?
I guess. You know, when I started, I remembered that the first kind of official act I did was a page and a half memo on why I needed a Mac because I was staring at real floppy disks, an old PC with floppy disks. And so I got my Mac and then I started buying to get email. And in 95, I had my first exhibition, which was about technology, but it was about technology of materials. It was called Mutant Materials in Contemporary Design. And I wanted a website. And MoMA didn't really know what a website was. So, you know, nobody wanted to sign off, communications, you know, development. Nobody knew what whose responsibility this was. And I got a budget of $315, which I used to take taxis and pay dinners to a graduate, you know, like a teacher and educator at the School of Visual Arts that actually taught me HTML and coded the website with me. So that was the first website for MoMA.
Interesting.
And a few months later, Barbara London did hers for her own exhibition, and then it became a real website.
So you were already, before you got to MoMA, you were already clued in or plugged in or beginning to get plugged into the internet.
Yeah. I cannot really remember. I remember when I was living still in Milan that I had a fax machine. And but I had also, for a short time, the Italian version of the Minitel.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So I had that. And then I had a Mac, which I had brought in from the United States. It was very funny. I walked through the customs in Italy with a big bag with a big apple in front of it with, you know, like still with a rainbow.
Yeah.
Anything to declare? Oh, no. Went through, and so I had my my Macintosh Classic at home, and I already had email.
Yeah,
but I don't know who taught me, well, maybe I do, because when I was working for Abitare and Domus, I was also spending time in Silicon Valley. I remember doing a piece on IDEO when they were still all engineers.
Right.
So I guess I was
interesting. Mm-hmm. And so for our listeners who don't know about the Minitel. This was essentially, there was one in France, there was one in Italy. It was
a terminal.
It was like this little terminal, and you would sort of dial up different services, 3615-movies or something.
Mm-hmm.
And
movies, you would get yellow pages, white pages. It was really very rudimentary.
Yeah,
yes.
But a lot of people had them
in
Europe at the time. And to some extent, I think it sort of slowed down the web a little bit.
Interesting.
Because people had this thing that already did some of that stuff.
You might have a point. Yeah, and it was distributed by the telephone companies.
Yeah.
So in a way, it was their own mean of distribution and dissemination.
How did you see the role in 1994? What was your take on what you were going to try and do and bring, and why was it interesting?
See, it's always an advantage when you notice right away that there's some glaring gap. You have your work cut out for you. And the glaring gap has not yet been remedied in the world. So many people in the world still think that design is embellishment, decoration, is something that you apply at the end when a product is already engineered and ready to market. And also many people think that design is furniture, that design is interior design. I mean, I encountered that every single day. So great. I just brought up my sleeves and I was ready to roll because design is so, so much more. And of course, now that we spend a great part, if not the greatest part of our life online, people also realize that there's a lot of design online, but the materiality of design used to be something that people could not do without. So I started out immediately trying to expand the notion of design, trying to use the amazing platform that MoMA is to let people understand where design is and also let people appreciate it, right? So my belief is that in the past decades, people have started appreciating technology. And when it comes to certain creative fields, for instance, movies or music, they can appreciate what a director of photography does. They know what tracks are. They are following on SoundCloud all of the different tracks at the same time. I would like them to do the same for design. Appreciate the rotation molding aspect of a particular trash can and just read the process in the final product, because it is as enthralling as a piece of music. It could be, and it's very useful. People need to know more about design so they can influence manufacture, they can push back, they can claim regulation and legislation. So it really is about being ultimately a fuller, better citizen and have a better understanding of life.
So your ambition and your thinking was to really expand the way people perceive design, not just coming to MoMA, but just generally using the platform of MoMA.
Absolutely. And it's not like I set out with this mission tattooed on my arm. You know, it's just something that you realize you're doing. And then in hindsight, you realize that you had that kind of mission. But I do believe the curator's job, not all curators, but my type of curator, is not to tell people what's good and what's bad, but rather to present them relentlessly with good examples or bad examples, depending on the occasion, so that they develop their own critical tools.
Tell me a little bit about the role of the museum at that time. And I'm asking this question because I think in, you know, whatever it is, 23, 4, 5 years since then, we've seen a huge transformation just as the world at large. A lot of art now is digital. A lot of experiences are digital. And while certainly at that time there was some of those things, I think most people probably at the time, the public, perceived art and design as physical things that they could maybe interact with or touch. And how has that changed? And how has it changed the way you showcase that and the way you curate that here?
Yeah, there's two different sets or levels of reading of what you're asking me. On the one hand, the role of the museum in society transcends material or immaterial. It's about whether museums are repositories or whether they're workshops, all the different metaphors that have been used for museums. But we can get to that later. I believe museums are the R&D of society. We'll talk about it later, perhaps. But when it comes to the object that is conserved, that is displayed in museums, you're completely right. It changed a lot. And actually, about 2-3 years ago, I ran a series of programs to talk about the object and how it's changed when we can deal with an online dimension. So when it comes to museums of modern and contemporary art dealing with objects that are also immaterial, that opens up a fabulous Pandora's box of issues. From how do you conserve code? And I discovered that code is more fragile than porcelain. Those who think that it's easier are completely mistaken. And also how you deal with the idea of ownership and responsibility. Because, for instance, when you acquire into the collection an object that is governed by an end-user license agreement, for instance, a digital typeface or a video game, it's not an ownership, but because it's the Museum of Modern Art, it has to be a perpetual license. You know what I'm saying? So it's really fascinating. You enter this territory that is very deeply also legal, but a dimension of legal that is almost creative. In fact, I really have a great time with the general counsel of MoMA, with all the lawyers that work at MoMA, because every now and then we have to tackle issues that are truly intellectual and conceptual, like when we decided to acquire or better anoint the at sign.
Right.
And I remember our counsel, Nancy Adelson, saying, Paola, this is definitely legally not a problem, even though conceptually it's really dense, you know? So it was really funny because she's right. This was legally not an issue because it's in the public domain, but conceptually, what does it mean?
And just to unpack a little bit, really the big sort of like big changes, at one point you brought up the vase. Museum brings a vase into a collection. The responsibility the museum is taking on is really, at the end of the day, is to preserve that vase, right?
Yes, preserve and show.
And sometimes the museum owns it. Sometimes it's lent to it, but that's the responsibility.
Well, in a museum, you have temporary exhibitions that are based on loans that then will be returned. So the responsibility of the museum is for that particular time. And the reason for showing is because there's a thesis behind the exhibition. And then there's the collection. The collection is a long-term responsibility. And also the criteria have to be more stringent because there's no theme that supports that object. It has to stand on its own merit. And the responsibility is to preserve it, to show it, to make it accessible to scholars, and also to incorporate it into a narrative that, in our case, is about modern art and design.
And so how does that, when you think then about the at sign, just to use your example, how does that challenge shift? You're no longer holding the at sign and making sure it's well-preserved. You're making sure people have access to it and can see it, or how do you think about that?
Well, and especially people have access to it and find it in the setting of the museum, so there's a displacement and a distance that leads them to think about it more deeply and to think about the role that it has in society and in our individual lives, the history behind it, its applications. And the at sign is just amazing because it has all the characteristics of great modern design. And from everything, from the reinterpretation of the past with current technology to the formal elegance to the impacts, everything. And at the same time, it is in the public domain. So it also leads us to that shift. And in a way, even though we acquired it many, many, many years ago, many, 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 I mean, I don't remember how many, but it must have been
2008 10. 2008 or 9
yes,
or something.
Yes, it must
like
have
that.
Been yeah. 10 years ago. So even though we acquired it then, we used to say, in the interviews at that time, that it brought the share economy into the museum in a way. Because,
yeah.
You know, it's about that. It's what we do today when we deal with cars, apartments, and many other elements of our lives that we use when convenient and we pass on to others. And in a way, it was the same concept.
Yeah. And part of your work when you acquire something is to know everything about it, too, right? Is to really research it. And so you must have talked to Ray Tomlinson, I'm sure, and found out the whole story about it.
We did. Ray was still alive at that time, and it was wonderful because, see, the whole at sign story was very progressive. It's not like we knew everything. It was an intuition one day that then went through many litmus tests. And one of the litmus tests was to ask Ray, did you know what the at sign was? And he said, oh, yes, I did. And actually, my first email was about the at sign. Because, see, the at sign has existed since the Middle Ages.
Oh, interesting.
Now, that's the beautiful thing. You know, that's when I say modern design. So here you have something that was used by the handwriting monks when they were copying manuscripts to kind of shorten the time that it took to write the Latin preposition ad, A-D, which meant already connecting objects or connecting people to objects. So he took something that had existed continually since the Middle Ages and was on the teletype writer that he was using, and he found out what the meaning of it was and decided to use it in exactly the same way to actually become the symbol that shortened the lines of code that he needed to connect the name of the person to the machine.
Right. A little ways back, there was this big, I don't know if you want to call it like a polemic, but now when I look back on it, it seems so silly that it was even a polemic, but there was this big thing where you brought in video games into mm-hmm. the collection, and there was all these people writing about how this was like the worst thing in the world, that the MoMA was bringing video games into the collection and that was going to be bad for art and all these things. And I think now any of those people probably will look back at that and just would probably think, I would hope, that it was the silliest argument.
Some of them. See, it was, there were not many people, actually. There were a few, but they were vociferous and they were, you know, revered or at least well-placed art critics, you know, like Jonathan Jones at The Guardian, for instance. And it was quite hilarious. Maybe he would think the same today. I don't think he would have changed his mind. But I was so taken aback by those critics, not because I couldn't take the criticism, quite the opposite, but because it didn't make any sense. First of all, they hadn't even read the press release, and because they're art critics, they think that everything is art and that design doesn't even exist. So he was saying, video games are not art. And I said, I didn't even
say they're
go
art.
There. Yeah. Then he would say, you cannot put Pac-Man next to Picasso. And I was like, you know, there are five stories in between, you know, but still. And the whole criticism was very ideological. And also, I was, nobody has thick skin enough as not to be hurt by criticism. And I am really thin-skinned. But in that particular case, I was not hurt at all. I was just like, almost with my jaw dropping, say, oh, no, no. I was embarrassed for them because their criticism was so not in touch with times and also was off because of this Pac-Man Picasso, all of these kind of blasphemous tones.
There's lots of things
like
in the moment.
Like if I were screaming something terrible in a church. And I just have to say it... it is really helpful to have a department of design and also department of media here at MoMA because so many of the criteria that are kind of fossilized about art can be broken by these two departments first and by film, and then they can percolate up or down, however you see the hierarchy, to the painting and sculpture and the drawings department. So,
can you explain that a little bit? Like, what do you mean by the criteria can be broken or which ones might have been broken?
Well, I have to say, I think that we have had a great collaboration with other departments in breaking the barrier of digital, you know. So even though it might seem very easy to say art is moving in the digital, so there we are, we have to start collecting, we have to start showing, etc. I don't think it was as easy for people like the critics that were so incensed about video games to accept that something that was not tangible and possibly with a brush and paint or an element of sculptural presence was art, right?
Right, yeah.
So I like to think that this museum, because of the wonderful interaction amongst departments, can help departments also pave the way for each other. Like, you know, I believe, for instance, that the media department has helped us tremendously in design with some acquisition. For instance, we acquired Max Headroom last year, which was really quite fascinating. And similarly, we helped them with also figuring out certain protocol for acquisition, like how do you acquire a digital entity? What do you acquire? How do you preserve it? So it's a much more systemic and complex set of issues that happens behind the scenes that are also really fascinating.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You have a salon series here. Yeah. You recently held a salon series on protests. I think one of the questions, if I'm paraphrasing, feel free to correct me, is there a DNA to protests or protest movement? What I wanted to ask you is, what did you learn from holding the salon? Just mm-hmm. briefly, I'm sure it was, I know it was a couple hours and people can watch it online and we'll have the link in the show notes. But what did you learn from it? And also tell me a little bit about, let's talk a little bit about the design that goes into the organization of those things, if mm-hmm. we can. We honored the founders and organizers of the Women's March last year at the Webbies. And, you know, predominantly because they used technology and the internet to organize what was probably the largest march in the history of the United States, maybe even the world, at least that we know of. And it seemed a bit like they had a very savvy skill at using the tools that were available. So tell me a little bit about what you learned through that salon.
Every salon has a lot of preparation behind it. So we pre-learn in a way. There's a wonderful research assistant that helps me. Then for each salon, we select four speakers. And those four are asked to prepare for 7 minutes. But also they send us a reading list beforehand. So we read a lot. And then we share the reading list with the people that are SVPs. So the beauty of these salons is that people come prepared, or at least they come knowing how much we worked before. So they come with a certain respect. So the questions usually are very good. You never hear those delirious kind of commentaries. And altogether, I think they're quite adult salons in the sense that the conversation doesn't start at the basis. It already is a little bit up in tone. When it comes to protest, we had four wonderful speaker plus a fifth that was a surprise. So the speakers were Jamal Joseph, who used to be one of the leaders of the Black Panther movement here in New York City, Biella Coleman, who's the foremost authority on online hackers, and she wrote the book on Anonymous. Then there was Kadrian Young, that is from the Hoodie March movement. And then we had Steve Shapiro, who's a photographer that documented so much of the civil rights history in America in the 60s and 70s. And then the surprise was Tania Bruguera, the artist that had that beautiful installation at MoMA that was at the Havana Biennale in the year 2000, but then was closed after an hour because it was too much for Castro to bear. So it was really quite a beautiful salon. And the prompt for the salon was, what kind of protest is effective today? What works? And what can we do? Is it only protesting with your wallet, like canceling, erasing Uber, that really can lead to some tangible outcomes? Or does it still matter to gather in the millions all over the world? And I learned a lot. I learned a lot also from the prep work. I had never watched the Angela Davis video when she was interviewed in prison in the early 70s, and she was talking about violence. So the meaning of violent protest versus nonviolent. I also learned about how the decades change the heaviness and the footprint of certain protests on people. My research assistant is from Milan, like me, but she's in her 20s. And when I hear Tony Negri, to me, he is the mastermind of the Red Brigades. And so many of my friends were touched in tragic ways by terrorism.
Tell people what the Red Brigades were.
Well, the Red Brigades was the foremost terrorist organization in Italy in the 1970s, responsible for the murder of Aldo Moro, among others. So real deep destabilization of the state and lots of fear and lots of tragedy. And he was the mastermind. Right now, after having been taken in by France when Mitterrand was actually protecting all of these different outlaws from different parts of the world, he has become a very well-known political theorist. So to my research assistant, Antonio Negri is a wonderful political theorist and philosopher. So it's really fascinating to see how things change. And I'm sure that to some of the people that were in the audience, Jamal also was a reminder of a really difficult and dark moment, while to me and to many other people, he's a great professor at Columbia University School of Film and a contributor to the intellectual life of New York and of the world. So it's interesting to see how protest gets metabolized and its effects can be felt at a distance or not. But I have to say that in the end, like with every salon, there were no real answers to the initial questions.
Sure, of course.
It's never about that. These salons are not about solving problems. They're rather about doing what New Yorkers love to do, which is talking about it with a group of, at the same time, like-minded and extremely different, differently minded people. So I think I definitely was enriched by what I learned.
Yeah.
Do I think differently about protest today? Perhaps.
Well, how important do you think have you thought about, or maybe just something you guys haven't really looked at or covered, but just the role of design in galvanizing people to attend, to become active, to be interested? Because the tool set really, I think you could say, well, there was communications back then and there's communications today. It definitely seems, from my perspective, that the tool set has materially changed in, the past, could say 10 years, maybe 5 years.
Design can be a distraction when it comes to protests. Like for the Women's March, we mostly remember the wonderful signs.
The signs, yeah.
And also my pet peeve, which is the pussy hat.
Mm-hmm.
Did they strengthen the protest or did they distract? Did they weaken it? Did they dilute it? So it's really interesting and it's fascinating because design can be an element of organization, an element of focus, or also an element of distraction because it can aestheticize events or situations to an extent that is hard to recuperate afterwards. But I have to say, the salons are not about design. They are museum-wide, and I try as much as I can to not focus on design too much. Otherwise, it goes into that particular field.
Sure.
Design is nonetheless important, and I also think that some of the posters that animated terrorism and resistance in the 1970s in Italy were quite remarkable. I would not touch them with a stick in the same way I wouldn't touch with a stick propaganda graphics from, say, the Nazi party
other.
Because, if you are the Wolfsonian in Miami, which is a museum that documents propaganda arts, that's fine. But once again, as a museum, you need to know who you are and what you're doing.
One thing you've talked about, I think, a bunch in the past is how the role of technology, when really good, hopefully fades into the background.
Mm-hmm.
I saw you do a really funny piece with Stephen Colbert on his old show, and he talked a little bit about, how the iPad should disappear, and he thought that was really funny. And I've heard you speak about this general concept. It seems like today, the role of technology is, especially like smartphones and devices, is doing anything but that, right? That not only is it not fading into the background, they are actually taking on physical space and presence and psychological space and playing a really almost human role sometimes in our lives. Would you agree or how do you look at that?
Technology will always be part of our lives. It's how integrated it will be. And it's true. We still have to hold these bricks and we have to have extra batteries for them. And we need to have chargers. And our life is filled with cables or anyway with like headsets and bits and pieces. But there are several companies that are working on neural implants trying different kinds of prostheses to see what works. We're still far from a real integration of technology in our bodies and in our life that doesn't make them so cumbersome. I think that the psychological space will never go away. I'm afraid that the different level and the different quality of communication is here to stay. And I say that I'm afraid because maybe since I'm not native digital, maybe I still feel sometimes a little bit of fatigue, but not that much after all. But still, I think that there will be changes in the way we behave. I have a sense that there will be more voice communication in the future. I was talking about it, and I'm not talking about dictation. I'm talking about interpersonal voice communication. Much as I am always uncomfortable talking with other human beings, I have to confess it. I have to admit that so much written communication is useless and is just a copping out, like an abdication of responsibility. So I have a feeling that we'll come to value more the risk-taking step of calling another person.
What would you say about the quality of the design around our devices these days? Do you think it's good, or is it slowed down, or do you
it's
have
a little
do you have a
boring
perspective? Yeah,
it's a little disappointing, but I don't know what's going to happen. I remember we were talking about the Minitel before, but at some point, it must have been 20 years ago, I don't know, Paper Magazine had distributed this device that looked like a strange vulva. It was really weird, and it was very organic, and it had a rubber cover, and then it had a little wheel. And it was basically a device that was connected to the wireless network, the telephone network, and would tell you what was going on that night in New York.
Oh, wow. I didn't remember that.
Oh, my
wow.
God. I still have it. It's a rarity. But at that time, that was maybe the time of also the Newton. So the design was like over the top, and the technology was still quite a disaster. But there was a little bit of freedom and of risk in the hardware. Right now, the hardware is completely standardized. The innovation is left to the interface. And the interface in itself is about overabundance. There's like too much. And I feel that happens every time there's a new technology or development in technology. There's a moment of drunkenness in which we try. So at that time, it was the hardware. Right now, it is maybe the icons, the apps, the different ways to talk with your phone, look at your phone.
Right, right.
And then maybe we'll sober up.
I would love to talk a little bit about the design of how people are consuming information and just talk a little bit about voice, because we were talking for a second there about people talking to machines. And I think one could say people used to consume the New York Times through a newspaper, or the New Yorker through a magazine, or Art Byte through a magazine. And there was all these signs, and then eventually at their website, right? And there was all these signs that actually gave people some information about whether they could trust this thing.
Mm-hmm.
The interface to some extent was branded, or it was unique. You could see where the information was coming from. Now people consume a lot of this information through Facebook or through Twitter, and a lot of the interface that people, I think, would use to help judge the information is now uniform, right? Do you think that's having an impact on people's ability to judge whether information is credible and viable and good?
I can't speak for everyone, but I don't think so. I think that people deserve more credit than we give them. I mean, I'm generalizing once again, but I believe that there are sources of information that are still reliable, and that people, in most cases, as we have seen, it's not truly so, but are able to detect and to gauge whether the information is credible or not. Of course, there's ways to ghost and to simulate reliable sources of information. But interestingly, and I don't mean to correct you or anything.
No, no, it's
I am
fine.
Trying to eliminate the word consumption and consumers and consuming from my vocabulary, because I feel that kind of passive role is what provokes people into making gigantic missteps and believing the wrong sources. So if we all stopped being consumers and were readers, citizens, just like active terminals of that exchange of information, maybe things would get better. You know, so I am glad that we've reached, I mean, even though it's been a really terrible path, but I'm glad that we've reached this moment of non-return in which gigantic companies have to take responsibility for filtering information. But yesterday, just last night, I was having conversations with different people that work in the digital realm. And we were talking about our favorite means of communication. And I'm not a very acoustic person, so I am recording a podcast with you, but I have to confess, I need visuals, and without visuals, I don't compute. And other people instead were really very comfortable in the acoustic realm only. And then yesterday, I was also talking with somebody from The Guardian, which has become a very reliable source of information for people like The New York Times, like The Washington Post. And we were talking about what happens when people are actively contributing. You know, The Guardian has now a model that also asks people for donation, and yeah, they have a 3-year plan, and they are the second year, and they're trying to gauge how that goes. Others, you know, Jeff Bezos taking over The Washington Post has surprised people with really having almost an idealistic attitude towards the newspaper. So I think that readers of The Guardian, readers of The Washington Post, readers of The New Yorker are asked to be active. I confess that I don't read Right magazine or conservative magazines and newspapers. Maybe they do the same. But I think that the best that we can do is not to be consumers.
My son the other day loves to, he's 8 and he really likes information about things. You know, so he loves categorizing things. He loves information about animals. And so he was telling me that a cheetah runs 200 miles an hour. And at first I was like, wow, that's so fast. And then I actually thought about it for a second, and I thought, a cheetah doesn't run 200 miles an hour. And then I asked him where he found that out, and he said he had asked Alexa how fast a cheetah runs. And then I thought, that's strange. So then I went back into the Alexa thing and looked, and it turned out...
It was 120. No.
Yeah, it's about... Yeah, it's a little less even. Mm-hmm. But Alexa had looked it up on some website where it was right next to a peregrine falcon. And so Alexa thought that the cheetah was running the speed of the peregrine. That made a mistake. But there's something really interesting there in that Alexa just flattens all the information down into this uniform voice. And if you believe Alexa generally, like if Alexa's correct most of the time, you might start to really just believe everything. And you just don't have, you bring up the visual, you know, on the website, you would see it, you would see where it was. You just get a bunch of more information there, I think, to help you evaluate that, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a long way of asking you, like, how are you thinking about the design of voice devices these days? And do you find that something interesting? And how well are they doing in terms of design?
Yeah, many of these devices are designed by a certain type of designer. It's very interesting because the design world is quite split. And I think it goes back to how expensive or non-expensive certain design schools are. So there are, in the past, the best designers, the ones that we admired, that we published in big magazines, etc., used to come from schools that were not that expensive. Say, Royal College of Art, Once Upon a Time, or even the Eindhoven Academy of Art and Design at the beginning. These were schools where students would go, Cooper Union also, yeah, you know, here in New York. Students would go and would feel empowered to take risks, to take creative risks, to try non-immediately commercial solutions, because they wouldn't get out of school with the burden of a student debt that would cripple them for decades. And instead, right now, so many of the design schools, even the ones like the RCA that used to be so so accessible financially, not accessible, you know, the exams for admission were really tough.
But
even those schools have become more expensive because budgets have been cut for culture all over the world because culture is not given the right metrics. This is another gigantic discussion. So I see many designers going into immediately commercial design and therefore not convincing big companies to take formal or productive risks and instead going towards a common denominator that is not necessarily the highest common denominator. Maybe not the lowest, but it's a middle one. Mm-hmm. So we see objects that are quite cylindrical in neutral colors. They cannot really be customized that much. Maybe the cylinder is cut at an angle, you know,
and maybe
wobbles a bit. But there's no daring. If you think of the first Macintosh, there's no equivalent of the first Macintosh in these devices. They don't come into our lives with a personality
So you think some of that is because of the price of the schools and the burden of debt that students are carrying?
I believe maybe, so. Yeah. I know that it's crazy, having seen it for a long time, and also there's a little bit of a split between the mentality of some of the big companies that tend to be on the West Coast and that think of design as product design, and instead there's so much design that is instead East Coast and Europe. This is a gigantic conversation could have.
For sure.
But so many of the manufacturers of these objects don't even know the name of some of the most famous designers that are instead in the space of furniture design or speculative design. Yeah. So there's a real disconnect.
Interesting. I have a friend who's a professor at SVA. He was telling me he gave his students a project. He told them that they were designing an object, and they could design anything, but they could not be the interface could not be a flat screen. And he said they didn't know what to do. They were like up in arms, upset, didn't know what to do. You know, it was like a big thing for them. They really pushed on them. The results, I think, ended up good or great. But that's where it all starts, because it's all interface design.
I went to Mass University. Mm-hmm. I paid like $100 $200 a year.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I know. And so I didn't have any overhead. I was also living at my parents', because that's typical from Italy. But I didn't have any overhead. So I was taking risks. I was like traveling to the US. I mean, I don't know what would have happened if I had come out of school with $150,000 of debt.
Right. Yeah. That definitely changes
probably
your perspective.
Probably wouldn't be here today. Yeah.
What do you think about, are you considering collecting algorithms?
Well, I never did it because I feel that design needs to have at least one sense involved, right? I need for the object to be either visual or haptic, or it needs to be the two things. I mean, you could also say that music could be designed, but it's so complex that I don't go there. But an algorithm is a means to an end. So it would be, even though I want to understand the beauty of code, and I've been trying to actually study a little bit of programming to get to that, to that understanding and awareness, still I think that an algorithm is a means to an end. So it's as if I were acquiring the tool that will get me to the design.
Interesting,
right? I appreciate those who acquire algorithms. And I know there was an auction a few years ago. But I think an algorithm is poetry, or it is a tool, or it is a piece of art, but it's not design.
Interesting. So it would be the design piece would be the interface
that
interacts. Interesting.
The outcome of the algorithm.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the Milan Triennial, which is coming up next year. It's pretty soon. You're one of the curators of, I think there's two or three of you who are curating it.
Well, no,
more.
It's me.
Just you?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I have a great team. So it's going to be, it's in the building that is the Triennale. So, and it's also the building where I started my whole career. So it's kind of, it's wonderful because as a student of architecture in my 20s, I was there as a gopher setting up the show.
So the Triennale, get to show them, huh?
Yeah. So the Triennial, it was founded in 1929. So it's been going on for a long time. And the building was built in the 1930s. And it's had this every 3 year with some hiatus during World War II, and then in the past 20 years, there's been these exhibitions that were really marking the point in time with architecture and design. And in this particular moment, it seems to me that we're dealing with big issues that are about having severed some of the ties that connect us to nature. And when I say nature, I don't mean only trees and oceans. I also mean other human beings, and I mean microbes. It seems like we've lost a little bit the thread of how to integrate our life in the world around us. And even though this kind of utopia, dystopia outlook has been repeated many times in exhibitions, I am also responsible for it. I would like this time not to remain in the field of speculative and critical design, but rather to have a triennale that presents viewers and citizens with real tools and possible strategies. It would be already enough if I were able to provide a taxonomy of possible issues that we should focus on.
Right.
So it's very wide right now because that's how I always curate. I start with a very wide idea that then gets sculpted as I find objects that support it.
And what do you mean by can you talk a little bit or elaborate on the idea of being disconnected from the rest of the world, I guess, is
absolutely. Well, when I present this concept, I often use that image that we've seen a few weeks ago in the New York Times that shows how in northern Guatemala, a Mayan city that was much, much, much bigger than one ever thought was discovered using a new technology that is almost like a sonar and a radar at the same time. And, you know, the Mayan civilization is very fascinating because it was incredibly sophisticated and advanced, but it became extinct. And it became extinct over a period of 500 years. So it was a slow burn. It was almost like cooking a frog. And I'm sure that the amazing intellect that was part of that particular people might have perceived this ending that was at the horizon. But because as human beings we're lacking this sense of far away, few generations away, they were not able to stop it. And we've been talking about the sixth extinction. I personally believe in it. And I believe that we will become extinct. I also believe that design can help us design a more elegant ending so the next species will remember us with a little more respect. But I also believe that we should be more aware of time. We should be more aware of our position in the universe. I know that these sound very highfalutin concepts, but ultimately they are about perspective. So I would like this Triennale to give people a sense of perspective and also give people some active tools. Once again, no consumption. It's about active tools that range from examples that show that waste is not waste, but rather a new kind of material, right? Or examples that are much more ethereal, perhaps, but like, you know, you might know about Stuart Brand and his thoughts about de-extinction. You know, he talks about... Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with Stuart Brand.
So, so the de-extinction project is not about bringing back to life T-Rexes and Brontosaurus. It's not Jurassic Park. It's about reintegrating in the world certain species that have become extinct that are maybe humble, like the passenger pigeon, but that were really important to the ecosystem and that, if brought back, could help us repair some of the severed ties. One of the concepts that the Triennale hinges upon is the idea of reparations. And I use this word that is so loaded. I use it with respect and with the awareness of what it means because I truly believe there's an urgency to having instilled in us a sense of indebtedness towards nature and towards also other human beings.
Paola Antonelli, thank you so much for joining us on the Webby Podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Paola for joining us on the podcast. If you're here in New York, we highly recommend you check out the MoMA's upcoming R&D salons, all curated and hosted by Paola at MoMARD.MoMA.org. And you can follow Paola at Curious Octopus on Twitter. Our producer is Sebastian Nade. Our editorial director is Nicole Ferraro. Research and writing by Jordana Jarrett. Music is Poddington Bear. Claire Graves is a chocolate babka. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.